Are there any questions on anything? I was going to say this is your last chance to ask, but of course, since I'm at Perimeter full time, you can just ask me questions whenever. I'll be happy to answer them. But this is an opportunity to ask questions, and I'm here. So, how do people feel about the class as a whole? Good. Okay. Were there topics that you thought needed more time or less time or something like that? Yep. On the algorithms. Okay. So on both of them, Shor's algorithm and Grover's algorithm, or was there one particular that was harder? Okay, so maybe just kind of the general more time on the algorithms. Okay, well, I'll think about that. Unfortunately, of course, these classes are kind of very short, and there's a lot of stuff to cover, so it's, you have to make tough decisions as to how much time to put in everything.
I think Grover's algorithm was totally fine.
Okay.
I mean, I think more like some of the details, like Fourier transform.
Okay. Any other? Right, sure. Yeah, so that would help for both of them, then, the counting. Okay, any other thoughts about the class? Okay. So then maybe we can get started on the last topic.
I want to ask, like, if you want to characterize a disturbance in a system that is offered, maybe by noise or by measuring, like, how do you really, what kind of measurements do you really use? Do you really use, like, rough measuring the entropy of the system, or the fidelity, or, like, maybe the weight of the operator or something?
Well, so frequently what, I mean, it depends what kind of view you're talking about. So theorists will come up with all sorts of measures, but experimentalists, most often what they want to do nowadays anyway is they actually do a full, what's called a tomography of the quantum state. So they measure the density matrix and try to learn the whole density matrix. So that's fine for now because people are dealing with small systems. The number of measurements you have to make, I mean, the number of entries in the density matrix is 4 to the n when you have n qubits. So this is something that that gets very, very hard as the number of qubits gets, you know, above 10. It's basically prohibitive. So what you can do is you can say, well, here's the ideal state I want to get and the state I actually got. And yes, you can calculate in terms of fidelity. Or there's another measure of distance called trace distance. I didn't really have time to talk about those. If I had just a little bit more time, I would have said more. And for the purposes of some things, it's good enough to look at kind of the average fidelity if you just kind of put in random states. But for other things, you want maybe the worst case fidelity or the entanglement fidelity. So you want to look at the If you quantify over all possible states you could put into this channel, you want to take the one that has the lowest fidelity, the worst fidelity. And that gives you some sense of the worst thing the channel can ever do. And so if it's if you put in any other state, it can be no worse than that. So for instance, if you want to calculate the effects of error correction, you want the worst possible input state to take your worst case, so that you know that if you do enough error correction to take care of that, then it will take care of anything. So it depends a little bit on what kind of application you want. But it's not something that's completely systematized. There's like a number of different things you can do. OK? Any other questions? OK, so the last topic I wanted to cover is information theory. And so I'm going to try to cover both classical information theory and quantum information theory. And as you know, I only have one lecture to do it. So I'm not going to go into very much detail. The field of information theory is actually quite a large one. And the stuff we talked about earlier in this week in quantum error correction and some parts of quantum cryptography and entanglement really relate to information theory. So it's not going to be totally new and totally divorced from what we've done so far. But there's some kind of core topics in information theory, and those I wanted to talk about today. So the first one is data compression. So information theory is primarily a communications type of task, although it has applications other places. And so data compression, like other communication tasks, you have an Alice who's trying to send something to Bob. And in this case, Alice has a variety of possible messages she wants to send to Bob. And these messages are not equally likely. Okay, so as you know, a good classical example, you want to send somebody a picture that you took. Okay, but the picture is not just a bunch of random bits, right? That would just look like static. It's a picture of maybe a person, right? So there's going to be certain regularities in this picture. You know, people have a face and two eyes and two ears and so on. And, you know, the background, there's various things you might find in the background. But again, it's not just random bits. There's, you know, if it's a picture of somebody on vacation, you know, they might be on the beach. And so there's a lot of water and blue water and stuff like that. And so there's certain things which will appear much more often and much more likely than other things. So the idea of data compression is to, instead of just giving every possible message an equal weight and then using the total number of bits you would need to send every possible message, you say, well, let's make the likely things into shorter messages. And the unlikely things will be longer messages, okay? And that means, on average, we can save a lot of space. And there's actually two kinds of data compression classically. There's lossy compression and lossless compression. So in lossy compression, you kind of ignore the really unlikely stuff and say, well, if it's something like that, we'll just fail. Or the distinction is a little dependent, actually, on whether you're talking about digital information, you know, that has just a finite number of possible states, or analog information, like, you know, theoretically speaking, music or a picture, you know, is originally analog information, right? It has some continuous degrees of freedom. But of course, if you take a photo with a digital camera, then it digitizes immediately. And so lossy compression can either be losing some of this analog information, or it can be kind of approximating the original by discarding the kind of really rare and unlikely parts of the image or music or whatever, and still getting something that kind of looks or hears pretty close to the original in when you process it yourself. And then there's lossless compression, which is, like I said, you have the likely messages being short and the unlikely messages being long. So if you get an unlikely message, you can still send it accurately. It's just that it will take more bits than would have if you had had done things evenly. So okay, so let me give a more concrete example of how data compression works. So the idea here is that Alice has a bunch of possible messages, I, and message I occurs with probability pi. Okay? So, and of course, the point I want to, as I said, the condition we're thinking about is that pi is not uniform. So some messages are more likely than others. So, for example, our goal, of course, is for Alice to send the message I to Bob using the fewest number of bits possible. Okay, this is still classical, so classical data compression. So, for instance, let's take the case where the messages are A, B, and C. And so we have probability a half that the message that Alice wants to send is A, and a probability one quarter that she wants to send the message B, and a probability one quarter that the message she wants to send is C. OK? So one way to do this would be to send 2 bits. OK? And A could be zero, zero, and B could be 0, 1, and C could be 1, 0. Okay? And we don't have a message D, but if we did, it could be 1, 1. Okay? So this is already wasting a little bit of space because we have 3 messages and we have 2 bits, so we have space for 4 messages. But even beyond that, it's not really saving anything because A, B, and C are not equally likely. A is more likely than B or C, but it's taking up as much space as B and C. So in this case, we're sending these 3 possible messages using 2 bits. If we were maybe a little bit more efficient and we somehow got rid of this 4th possibility, we'd be using actually log base 2, 3. Bits per message. So, for instance, you could achieve this if you looked at if you instead of sending bits, were sending trits that had 3, you know, 0, 1, and 2. Okay. Can we do better than that? And the answer is yes. That was the whole point of this example. If we compress, well, since A is more likely, let's make it a shorter message. We'll make it a 1-bit message. If we get an A, we'll send a 0. Okay? If we get a B, well, we can't send a 0 because, and we want to send a 2-bit message. We can't do something that starts with 0 because then we'll get it confused with A. So instead, we'll send 1, 0 for B. And for C, we'll send 1, 1. Okay? And you see that Bob on the other side, if he gets a string of bits, which could be long because it could be many messages that Alice wants to send, he'll look at the first one. If it's a 0, he'll say, oh, the first message is A. And if it's a 1, he'll say, OK, the first message is either B or C. I have to look at the second bit to figure out which message it is. And he'll do that, and he'll see, say, the second bit is 0. And he says, oh, it's B. And so if you have some string of bits, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, I don't even know if this is, I just made these up, so I don't know if this is an equal number of messages. We'll see. So Bob can look at this, and he parses it. He says, OK, this first 2 is a B. And then we'll discard those and start from here. We get a 0, so that must be an A. And the next one is a 1, so we have a B or C, and it's a 1, 1. So that's a C. OK. And this next one, 1, 0, is a B. And then another 1, 0, so that's another B. Okay, so Bob says, okay, Alice sent me B A C B B. Okay, which doesn't really spell anything interesting, but after all, I only had 3 letters. Okay, so the point here is that on average, Alice has to send fewer bits than in this case. Let's calculate how many bits. So with probability 1/2, she has to send 1 bit. For A. With probability a quarter, she has to send 2 bits for B. And then with probability a quarter, she sends 2 bits for C. Okay? So that's a half plus a half plus a half is 3/2. And if you calculate it, 3/2 is, well, it's definitely less than 2, but it's also less than log 3 base 2. Okay? Now, in this particular example that I came up with, it's actually longer, right? Because it turns out there's extra Bs and Cs. But of course, this is a very short sample. So if you came up with a much, much longer message, then it should have twice as many A's as B's or C's, as many A's as B's and C's put together. Okay? Okay, so one remark I think is worth making about this scheme, which is that actually the string that Bob gets, so Bob needs to know, of course, what this coding method is in order to decode. Okay, that's something that Alice and Bob agree on ahead of time. If you don't know what the coding method is, the string of bits that Bob is getting looks completely random. And the reason for that is, well, if you look at the first bit in the message, right, with probability half, Alice was sending an A, so the first bit is 0. And with probability half, she's sending either B or C, so the first bit is 1. Okay? And then if the first bit was 1, it's equally likely that the second bit will be 0 or 1, because B and C are equally likely. Okay? If the first bit was 0, well, the second bit is now the first bit of a new message. And so again, it's equally likely to be A or B or C. So it's, again, equally likely to be 0 or 1. Okay? And so on. If you look at the third bit, well, it could be the second bit of the second message, if the second message started with 1, or it could be the first bit of the second message, or it could even be the first bit of the third message if the first two bits were both 0. Okay? But either way, the first bit of any message is equally likely to be 0 or 1. And the second bit, if you have 1, is equally likely to be 0 and 1. So the string of bits that you get out of this is uniformly random. Each bit is equally likely to be 0 or 1. Okay? And that's not a random thing. That's an important feature of compression. And in fact, you'll always have it with an optimal compression scheme, that the string of bits you get out of it is completely random. Of course, if your scheme is not completely optimal, but only close to optimal, then it'll just be close to random. Okay? And there's a good reason for that, right? Which is that we have some number of messages we want to send, and we have some number of messages we can send. Right? And the number of messages we can send, if we send n bits, is equal to 2 to the n. Okay? And so what we have to do is we have to arrange it so that our most likely messages get sent first, get sent with smaller number of bits, and that's how the compression works. So that's that's the kind of the key to generalizing this particular scheme. Yeah.
Did you get that counting of bits per message more to 3 bits?
This one? Oh, well, okay. So actually, it's probably better if I come back to that. That will be more obvious in a few minutes, I think. Okay. For the moment, in the really stupid version, where we also have a D that goes 1-1, and it's actually 2 bits per message. This is the slightly more efficient. That's in some sense already compressed, but with equally likely A, B, and C. Okay, so so what we want to do more generally, the easiest way to handle this issue is using something called block compression. So what I did here was actually something different. It's called variable length coding or Huffman coding. But it's a little more complicated to explain how this generalizes, and it's hard to achieve optimal compression using just Huffman coding. You have to use something more complicated where you have the compression of messages depends on the previous messages that got sent and so on. This case, the numbers were picked so that you could do perfect compression, but that's not always possible. OK, so block compression. The idea is Alice wants to send a large number of messages. And again, they're drawn from a non-uniform source. So the idea here is, like I said, we're going to take the most likely messages and make them into short things. And in this case, I'm going to do lossy compression. So I'm going to make the most likely the likely messages and by messages here, I mean strings of messages into short strings to send. And I'm going to ignore the unlikely strings of messages, unlikely sequences. OK? And the idea here is I should pick the set of likely messages, also known as the typical. The typical set, so that the total probability of getting something from this typical set is very close to 1. And in particular, it approaches 1 as the number of messages goes to infinity. Okay? And what's perhaps surprising, but certainly the important insight of Shannon, was that you can do this in such a way that the total number of bits that you have to send is much less than the total number of bits needed to describe every possible message. Okay, so if you have a k possible messages, right, the so the total number of possible sequences is k to the n, right? Which we can write as 2 to the n log k. Okay, therefore, if you wanted to send every possible message, then you need n log k bits. So that's where this log 3 was coming from. Okay? This clear? Okay. But it turns out that the number of typical messages only about n, sorry, 2 to the n h of pi. And h of a random variable, so if x is a random variable, then the entropy of this random variable is, I actually wrote it down on Wednesday, I believe, is minus sum pi log base 2 of pi. Okay? Which again is the basically the same as the von Neumann entropy. This is called the Shannon entropy. But in the basis where the density matrix is diagonal. Right? And in fact, it's exactly equal to that, because we have a classical random variable. So if we wanted to write this as a quantum state, we'd write it as a density matrix, as a mixed state. And it would be a diagonal mixed state, because it's classical. There's no superpositions. Okay? And in that case, we would get, for the von Neumann entropy, we would get exactly this formula. Okay? And so that gives us Shannon, I mean, so, yeah. So that gives us Shannon's source coding theorem. And furthermore, we can't do better than that. So if you try to send n messages from the source x with asymptotically fewer than n h of x, so n times h of x minus epsilon, then the fidelity will go to zero. Okay, you'll basically be missing a lot of messages. And messages that occur with, you know, reasonable probability. Okay? So I'm not going to prove this to you. One of the tutorial problems is kind of a related thing, so you'll get to do a similar counting and maybe help understand where this number comes from. But are there questions on this? Yeah.
How much does all of this depend on knowing very well the kind of data you're sending? It seems if,
right.
If I wanted to like encode, you know, a language, I would have to a good amount of time to analyze what letters happen often, what letters don't.
Right. So that's a rather interesting question. The answer is it depends a lot, and it also depends not at all. Okay. So. So let's handle the not at all first. So in this scenario that we're talking about, each message is independent of the previous messages. So this is an IID source. So okay, this. All right. So IID is independent. Identically distributed. Okay, so each message has its probability distribution is not dependent on what the previous messages were; they're uncorrelated, and the probability of different kinds of messages is the same as you go to each message. And so, in this case, you don't need to know ahead of time. What the source is, because what you can do is you can look at a whole bunch of, I mean, this is in the block limit, right? So we're looking for many, many things drawn from this source. And so what you can do is you can look at it and see what the source does, right? If you have a million messages of this type, right, you can look at them and see that, oh, well, about 500,000 of them are A, and about 250,000 are B, and about 250,000 are C. So therefore, I guess the probabilities of these messages should be pretty close to this. And then I can come up with a compression scheme that does that. And of course, Bob has to know what the compression scheme is. But all that really means is he has to know what the algorithm is that takes these probabilities and converts it into a compression scheme. Okay, so that's called a universal compression scheme. And in fact, you can write very good universal compression schemes, and people do. Now, the problem is that when you're talking about something like a language, and really actually a lot of real data, this assumption no longer holds. Right? The probability of certain letters changes rather dramatically depending on what the previous letter was. So for instance, if you have a Q, then the next letter is almost certainly going to be a U. You know, there's a few exceptions, but if you're talking about Qatar, for instance, it's not. But in English, anyway. That means that in order to write a good compression scheme for a language, you want to know the correlations between different things, because you know if the previous letter was a Q, you don't really have to write the U at all. You just put QU as one thing. And it's not a very likely letter, so it's not going to be necessarily a short thing. But QA is much less likely, so that should be even longer. Right. And the problem is that when you get to something as complicated as language, it goes even further than that, right? It's not just letter-to-letter correlations. If you have one word, then that greatly affects the probabilities of the next what the next word is going to be. And longer and longer phrases, you can put more and more things that you know about the language into it to get a better and better compression scheme. And so for something like that, you really do need to, if you want to get an even better compression scheme, which might be possible, you can put in more study and try to understand better what the source is. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. Oh yeah.
Doesn't the way you compress data also depend on the type of data? Like you can't do lossy compression to all kinds of data that you can come up with.
Well, yes and no. So I mentioned this at the beginning. There's kind of two things that you can think of for lossy compression. So one of them is when you're taking analog data that's originally analog, and then you convert it to something digital, and then you compress that. Or try somehow to compress the analog stuff right away. And in that case, there's always some loss in the process of digitizing. Actually, they call it quantizing, but in this class, that would be confusing. And so there's some inherent loss there. But if you use enough points to approximate, it's a very small loss. But then there's this loss that comes from basically ignoring the unlikely sequences. So, there's various ways you can do this, but you can, for instance, lump together a lot of different messages which kind of look the same, right? So that would be pictures that only differ by maybe a few pixels in areas that your eye might consider unimportant. And that's another kind of lossy compression. And that you can do just as well with any kind of data that's inherently digital. But in order to do it well, you need one of two things. Either you need really this IID assumption to be valid, so you can just say, well, those sequences are very unlikely. We're just going to throw them away. It doesn't matter what we do with them. Or you need to know something about, for instance, how your eye processes pictures to say that certain pixels are not very important. It's kind of a subtle issue that experts in this, I think, will spend a lot of time worrying about, you know, how what's a good way to do lossy compression versus lossless compression. And then it will depend on the type of data if you really want to do it the best way. But at least theoretically speaking, when you have this IID assumption, you can just throw away these things and say, well, they're very unlikely to occur, so we won't even notice that they're there. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, so then let's get on to quantum compression. Also known as Schumacher compression. And yes, that's the same Schumacher who taught your quantum mechanics class. So he's the one who figured out how to do this for quantum information. If Alice now wants to send quantum information to Bob, she can compress it in much the same way that you can compress classical information. So it's worth noting, I don't know if he mentioned this, probably not, but Ben Schumacher was also the one who came up with the term qubit. Okay, you'd heard that before. Okay. How does Schumacher compression work? Well, so in the quantum case, we again say we have a bunch of messages I that occur with probability pi. But now the messages are quantum states. So the messages are states psi I, and they occur with probability pi. So the way we would describe this in a quantum system is as a density matrix, right? We have probability pi of pure state psi I. And we have this whole formalism for dealing with that. So we'd say the density matrix is sum over I pi psi I psi I. Okay? And so, of course, there's many interesting things about this. One of them is that classically, if you have a mixture like this, there's only one way of writing it as a mixture of messages. But in the quantum case, when you have a mixed state like this, there's more than one way of writing it. Okay? And so in the quantum case, there's actually a little bit of subtlety in what we mean by getting the message through. Okay? In the classical case, it was clear, right? Alice got the message I from this source, whatever it is, and Bob is supposed to receive the same message I. Right? It's not enough if Bob just receives a mixture of A, B, and C with the right probabilities. He has to receive actually the correct one at the correct time. Okay? So in the quantum case, because there's more than one decomposition, it's maybe not obvious how to see what's going on here. And so one solution is to use what's sometimes called a reference system. So this down here is rho, the thing that Alice is getting and is supposed to compress and send to Bob. And what we have is a state that's a let's call it big phi, which is a purification of rho. Okay? And the idea is that, you know, Alice does something and she sends it through the channel, and then Bob Bob decompresses it and gets something out of the channel. And the idea is we're supposed to be preserving the entanglement with rho. Okay? So if we're doing somehow perfect compression, which actually is not really possible in the quantum case, Alice, the state that we get out at the end between the reference system and Bob will be exactly this state phi. And in the real case, it won't be exactly phi. It'll be something close to phi. Okay, it'll have high fidelity to phi. I know I didn't talk about fidelity, but what can you do? Okay? So that's really the only conceptual issue with quantum compression. And then the solution of how to do this and how well you can do it is actually very simple, and it follows easily from the classical case. And so the solution So again, we're going to work in the IID case. So each time Alice is getting a message, row. And let's assume that she knows what row is. Turns out you can also do universal quantum compression when you don't know what row is. But it's easiest if we think that Alice knows what row is. And the solution for her is to diagonalize row. You can always do that. And now you just have a classical probability distribution. And then you can perform classical block compression in the eigenbasis of row. But of course, you have to do this coherently. I mean, if you measure in the eigenbasis, then you've instantly destroyed this entanglement. So you don't want to do that. But if you just do, you know, a classical reversible version of this, reversible version of this classical compression algorithm, and you do it with quantum gates so that it's coherent, then you'll get a good compression scheme. And the solution is that you compress n messages to n s of row qubits. And you know this is approximately, and the fidelity goes to 1 as n goes to infinity again. OK? Any questions on that? No? Okay. So I've used up most of the time talking about compression, but I do want to say a few words about the other big task of information theory, which is noisy channels and channel capacity. So again, here we have Alice sending to Bob. In this case, we have a noisy channel. Okay, so in this sense, it's just like quantum error correction or classical error correction if we're dealing with classical data. But we want to consider the asymptotic case. Where the number of messages goes to infinity. So I didn't show you specific examples of codes that encoded multiple qubits when we talked about quantum error correction. But with the stabilizer formalism, for instance, you can easily come up with codes that do. Okay, and the idea is you send many messages all at once. A code that encodes many qubits is in general going to be more efficient than a code that just encodes one qubit or a small number of qubits. And similarly for classical codes, a code that encodes many bits is more efficient than a code that encodes a few bits. So channel coding and channel capacity is a study of how well you can do in this asymptotic limit. So let's see. So classically, suppose we want to send k bits through the channel, We want to encode them as n bits. Okay? And of course, we want to get an answer that's correct. But we're not going to insist that it be perfect. We just insist that we do it very accurately. So the probability of succeeding should go to 1 as the number of bits we're sending goes to infinity. Okay. So then the capacity of this channel is going to be the optimal k over n. So I should talk a little bit about what a channel does in this case. So for a classical channel, well, you put in some, so it might not be a channel that operates on bits. In general, we can talk about, you know, dits that have, you know, 10 states or 3 states or 72 states or whatever. And the channel will operate on those things. And you put in something. And since it's a noisy channel, you don't always get out the same thing. There's some probability of getting things out. So in particular, if we put in bits, so the way this is frequently modeled is we put in bits or states more generally described by a random variable x. We get out something described by a random variable y. And the point of this is that x and y are not independent random variables. Okay? Y is correlated with x. And the way we like to quantify that correlation for the purposes of channel capacity is with something called the mutual information. And the mutual information is defined as I of xy, and it's equal to h of x plus h of y minus h of xy. Okay? So this is kind of the amount of randomness in x. And this h is the same as the h over here, the Shannon entropy. So this is the amount of randomness in x, the amount of randomness in y, and the amount of randomness when you consider both together. Right? So this is like that subadditivity inequality that I showed you for the von Neumann entropy. It also applies for the Shannon entropy. And the point here is that the mutual information is the the amount of randomness that you lose by considering both of these together, right? Because that's the redundancy kind of in the randomness between the two separate things. I'm afraid I don't have time to really go into this in much detail, but the point is that this turns out to be a very good measure of the amount of correlation between x and y. And the correlation between the inputs to the channel and the outputs to the channel is exactly what you need in order to do channel coding. So, in fact, Shannon's channel coding theorem states that the capacity of the channel which takes the variable x to some random variable c of x is the max over possible input distributions x of I x c of x. Okay. And the proof of this is maybe a little bit more involved than the proof of this source coding theorem. But it's not too bad. And the basic idea is we have to pick a sequence of good error-correcting codes. Okay? And it turns out that actually picking random codes is a very good thing. And if you pick them with this rate, then it turns out you can decode them with high accuracy. And so, of course, you need to do some calculations to justify that. Okay? So the nice thing about this is that even though the channel capacity is calculated in the large N limit, this formula only involves a single use of the channel. Okay? So in practice, if you know what the channel does, and again, this is under the assumption that the channel acts independently on each thing that you put into it. So if you put two messages, x1 and x2, into it, what comes out is c of x1 and then followed by c of x2. Mm-hmm. Okay? And of course, in real life, that's not necessarily the case. The channel can have correlations. But in this ideal case, if you know what the channel does, you can calculate its capacity. Okay? Now, it may be difficult to find kind of an efficient code that achieves that capacity. But in practice, people have gotten pretty good at that, classically. Okay? There are questions on this? So in that case, I want to just start to talk about quantum channel capacity. And I'm not really going to get to do more than put up a whole bunch of formulas. But at least I can maybe give you an idea of kind of what we know how to do in the field and what we don't know how to do. So quantum channel capacity. Same idea. Alice wants to send qubits to Bob. The channel is noisy. Therefore, she'd like to find some good error-correcting code that, in the asymptotic limit, sends the largest number of qubits, of logical qubits, per physical qubit. Right? So she wants to, again, maximize k over n. So what we know about the quantum capacity is so in the quantum case, the channel is described as a completely positive map. So I'll write it as a curly E. And the quantum capacity of E is given by the sup over N, 1 over N, max over rho, I c, rho tensor, e tensor n. Okay. So a number of things to notice. So first of all, this rho is on n copies of the input Hilbert space. And then we have this formula, where IC of rho, let's call it F instead of E, is equal to S of F of rho minus S of E. So this is in a picture where you have Alice sending to Bob And the channel F is purified. So you have some ancilla input and some X group qubits that get thrown away, and these go to the environment E. Okay? So this is the entropy that Bob receives. And this here is the entropy that the environment receives. Okay, so the quantum channel capacity is given kind of by the excess information that Bob receives over that of the environment. The point here is that there's a lot that can be said about this, but one point is that when the environment learns a lot about the state, that means that it's getting decohered. Okay. And kind of the amount that the environment learns is quantum information that Bob is not receiving effectively. And so that's some maybe kind of intuitive understanding of this formula. Okay, are there questions? Okay, so the other thing I want to point out about this formula is that it's regularized. I did it for large N. It took the coherent information. Oh, sorry, I didn't name this. This IC is called the coherent information. And so this coherent information, I took it for many uses of the channel, and then I divided by n. So I'm kind of averaging over n uses of the channel. And then you want to take the limit for large n of how well you can do with this. Okay? Now that's different, remember, from this classical capacity. Classical capacity, we just had to use it once. This is called the single letter formula. Whereas this one is not. And the reason for that is that the classical mutual information is additive. In the sense that we talked about on Wednesday, that if you have two uses of the channel, well, that max over x then you maximize, you get the same thing as if you had just one use of the channel. But the coherent information is not additive. And remember, I said on Wednesday that the entanglement of formation was not additive. So in the coherent information is actually the non-additivity is even worse than with the entanglement of formation. Okay, so what that means in practice is that while we have this formula for the quantum channel capacity, we don't actually know how to calculate it. And worse than that, we don't really even know the channel capacity for even some very simple channels. For instance, we don't know the depolarizing channel. Which just says that you, with probability 1 minus p, you take the initial state rho. And with probability p, you have one of the three Pauli matrices. So we don't know the channel capacity of this channel. Okay? So let me just finish with one last formula. Again, I'm not going to really have time to discuss it, but I'll just throw it up there. And so the case of quantum mechanical capacity is a little more complicated, actually, because there's a lot of different kinds of quantum mechanical capacity. And so, for instance, one thing that you can say is, well, in the classical case, it's always you're just sending classical information over a classical channel. In the quantum case, you can send quantum information over a quantum channel. That seems natural. But it's also interesting to talk about sending classical information through a quantum channel. And maybe you can take advantage of the quantum effects to send more classical information than you would have through a noisy classical channel that was similar. And in fact, it turns out there's some cases where it's best that Alice sends non-orthogonal states when she wants to send classical information. OK, so the theorem here says that the classical capacity of a quantum channel E is given by the supremum over N, 1 over N, chi of E tensor N. And so chi is known as the whole of a chi quantity. And so chi is equal to, again, we have a maximization of over, this time over ensembles, of S, okay, why don't I put it up here, actually. Okay, and so the idea is you send, remember we're sending classical messages, so the idea is you're going to send classical message J using the message rho J. And we're maximizing that over distributions of classical messages, just like in this classical channel encoding theorem, we're maximizing over random variables. Okay? So that comes into the calculation of channel capacity. And so then this thing here is kind of the average density matrix that Alice is sending. And so this formula here is when you put that density matrix into the channel, then this is the entropy that Bob gets out. Okay, and you compare that over here with, if Alice sends the message J, then Bob gets out E of rho J, and that has entropy S of E of rho J. So this is the average entropy. So this is the entropy of the average minus the average of the entropies. And so that turns out to be the right formula for how much classical information Alice can send. But unfortunately, we again don't have a single letter formula. Okay. And this was discovered a few years ago. And in fact, it was known for a long time that additivity of the whole of a chi quantity was equivalent to the additivity of the entanglement of formation. So the fact that they're not additive was discovered at the same time. And for a long time, people thought that they were additive, probably. And so it was at the time, it was a surprise. So again, we don't know the classical capacity of very many quantum channels. Now, in the case of the classical capacity and the entanglement of formation, things are actually, it's much less additive. Sorry, it's much closer to additive, as far as we know, than the coherent information. So actually, there are a fair number of channels where we do know the classical capacity. But there's still plenty of channels where we don't know, and where we don't know how to compute it at all. Because, again, it involves this infinite maximization where you might have to go to arbitrarily many uses of the channel. Okay? So I know this channel capacity stuff went by pretty fast. I just wanted to show you the formulas and give you a sense of kind of the main things we did know and the main things we don't know, because they're so close together in this case. But people, when they talk about channel capacities, actually talk about a bewildering variety of stuff. I mean, you can say, well, what if you want to send quantum information, but you already have some shared entanglement? What's the best rate at which you can do that? And you know, suppose you want to trade off between classical bits and quantum bits. What's the best way that you can do that? And people consider all sorts of different situations. These are kind of the most common ones and the most inherently interesting ones. But it turns out that there's a lot of relationships between all of these different kinds of information theory problems. And that's something that's been largely worked out over the last, I don't know, 5 years or so. So that's still a pretty active area of research. OK. I guess I can see if there's any final questions. No? OK. Like I said, I will be around at PI. So if you do come up with further questions, let me know. Thanks.
On that, Robert would like to know if you have any size shirt that's his green is your is wrong size and you can swap it to Oxford for
okay.
So it's a expected for the current.
Thanks.
And we have a card which is actually quantum gate.
Ah, I see. Okay.
Thank you very much for the great talk.
Thanks.